Hey everybody, it is James from the future here with a quick content warning. Because we are talking about, partially anyway, Carthaginian religion, that means that we are going to be discussing human sacrifice and particularly children in power. Well, I don't know, could be an adult son in this instance, but sooner or later in this discussion, it's going to come up. And so there's a little bit of it in today's episode, and I wanted to make you aware of that. I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Also, at various points in this episode, I talk about the Assyrian and Babylonian languages. Traditionally, these were treated as two separate languages, but I think today most scholars regard them as two branches or dialects of a single language, which we would call Akkadian. So, I do know that, but when you're talking about the Assyrians, then it's easy to just say Assyrian, you know what I mean? But yeah, it's all Akkadian, really. Okay, now I really return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and in this series, I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world, seeking inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. This is the first real episode in our series on the myths and legends of the Phoenicians, the culture who flourished in the ancient Near East, both in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Bronze Age and up to the age of Alexander the Great, and then, of course, as the Carthaginians in the Western Mediterranean. In our last episode, we took a look at the historical and cultural background of the Phoenicians, and we identified some of the challenges that face us in terms particularly of the lack of written sources from the Phoenicians themselves. Now, in today's episode, we're going to take a look at the supreme god of the Phoenician pantheon, maybe, and it's very noticeable that the majority of sources that we're going to be using are not Phoenician, or are Phoenician only at a certain distance. What I mean will become clear when we start talking about this. So let's start talking about it. As I said in our last episode, the cults that were of primary importance in the different city-states that made up the Phoenician world in the Eastern Mediterranean differed from place to place. But that didn't mean that the people of, say, Tyre didn't believe that the deities worshipped in Byblos were real. They believed in them, they just weren't their particular deities. This is sometimes called monolatry, although we're not talking about monolatry here because multiple gods were worshipped. Henotheism maybe is the word I'm looking for. That is to say the acceptance that there are multiple deities, but you don't worship all of them, I guess. This type of model is quite common in RPGs, I think. Let's say you have a party where you have a cleric of St. Cuthbert and a cleric of Cord. Neither cleric thinks that the god worshipped by the other doesn't exist. They sort of objectively know that they exist, but that doesn't mean that they overlap very much. The cults may maintain a respectful attitude toward one another. In the real world, that type of overlapping probably happened all the time. So you might come from a city that particularly worships Melkart, but if you happen to be somewhere else and there's a sacrifice to the local gods going on, you're going to participate. Or if you have some specific purpose in mind, when you arrive in a new setting, you might make a sacrifice to the deities that would be found in that setting. That would just make sense. This is a cosmology, the boundaries of which are quite mushy, and where other cultures take a look at your thing and go, ah, you worship Melkart, we call him Heracles, or whatever. So all of these deities do loosely fit into a shared cosmology, and that cosmology is one that's going to seem pretty familiar if you've been listening to the show for a while. It has a lot of similarities to the cosmologies we've seen in our Sumerian and Babylonian episodes, and, to be frank, with other religious frameworks in the region. And in fact, a lot of the time, it's those other religious frameworks that we have to use to infer things about the Phoenicians and their beliefs, and it might not always be the case. So for instance, a lot of the evidence that I'm going to talk about in this episode comes from what are called the Ugaritic texts. And these are documents from the city of Ugarit in what is today Syria, written mostly in the 12th and 13th centuries BC in the Ugaritic language, which is related to languages like Assyrian or Babylonian. These contain lots of different kinds of documents. They include myths and legends. They include, like, teaching texts. So one of the sources that we have for the order in which letters were presented in the Phoenician alphabet is like an educational text. Even though the Ugaritic language didn't typically use the Phoenician alphabet, it was written using cuneiform-like Sumerian or Babylonian. And these different documents include lots of references to various deities, including a creation myth, including a lengthy sort of saga about Baal. I know it should be Baal. I'm probably going to keep saying Baal, just seems to be spelled that way to me. Anyway, whatever. And one of the deities described in these texts is the deity that we're going to talk about today, El. El is basically, I mean, for want of a better word, he is God. I mean, this is a polytheistic culture, so he is a god, but he's also the god, the supreme deity, creator of life, father of other deities. So just as in English, El, like imagine the English word God. So I could talk about a god, or I could be using it as the specific name of a particular deity. If I was, you know, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, I might say God to describe the god that my faith worships, while also saying, like, the Vikings believed in Thor, the god of thunder. So it's just the same with El. The word El is used to describe other deities at times, so it can be a little bit confusing. If you're at all familiar with the history of the Bible, you'll know that El is used as a name for God. In that text, I don't want to get too deep into biblical history, which is very far from being my area of expertise, but I do know that some historians of religion believe that El was originally one of a pantheon of deities. As monotheism emerged, they were unified into a single being, which is why that sometimes God is called El and sometimes God is called Yahweh and so on. But within the Ugaritic context, El is an important deity, although he did not have a temple there, unlike some of the other gods we'll be covering. He was seen as a significant figure, and he turns up in Phoenician religion as well. In the limited evidence that we have for Phoenician El, we can see that he fulfills similar roles to the Ugaritic El. Names of El in the Ugaritic texts include El of the Covenant, El the Creator of the Earth, El the Judge, El the King, El the Patriarch, etc., etc. So this would give us the impression that he basically represents a kind of cosmic authority figure, and indeed he is the father of the deities of like day and night and things like that, so very associated with these kind of core cosmic contexts. So, the Ugaritic texts are not the only texts that tell us about El, and one text that talks a little bit about El is a little complicated. This is a text commonly called something like the Sankuniathon, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, and its backstory may go something like this. At some point in history, and we're not sure exactly when, there was a Phoenician author called something like Sankuniathon, whose work was translated into Greek by a Greek resident of Byblos, and then summarized and excerpted by a later Christian author called Eusebius. So what we have is a summary of excerpts of a translation of the original text. Maybe. I say maybe because, in fact, there may never have been an original Sankuniathon, and Philo, the Greek author, may have made him up to make his own work sound more authentic, or he may have taken the work of somebody else and attributed it to a semi-legendary author. We don't know, but it's something that we have to be conscious of because this kind of thing happens all the time in the ancient world. You would be surprised the number of people that you are used to thinking of. I mean, that is to say, if you haven't studied the history of this period very much, but people who, you know, whose names are attached to like important scientific principles or mathematical ideas or things like that, for whom there is very little evidence that they ever existed at all, or if they did, about whom nothing is really known, right? All the stories that we have about them come from much later. Anyway, what I'm saying is these people did not give a heck about proper attribution. Anyway, in the story originally written by Sankuniathon and then translated by Philo and then excerpted by Eusebius, according to Eusebius, in that story, El is not the first god. He's associated not with the kind of primordial creator, but with sort of a generation below that. Although, I think the creator god is Elion, which may also be El. This author associates El with the Greek mythological titan Cronus. There are other sources that suggest he might be associated with Poseidon instead, although I think that's a bit more speculative. I do think that there could be some room to argue that El is a sea god, not a sky god like Anu or somebody. He's said to dwell near the springs of two streams in the deep. This may mean like the water of the earth and the water of the sky, or it may mean salt water and fresh water generally. We also know that he rules over an assembly of gods. In the myths about Baal, El is seen kind of convening the gods. Now, obviously, these are not concepts which are specific to Phoenician society, but we have seen some texts that suggested that assemblies were an important part of city governments, although perhaps less so in the early period that these texts come from. And if you want to make a kind of simplistic generalization, you might say that the universal deity of a maritime culture might be a water god. Now, of course, these are not actually Phoenician texts, but Ugarit was also a port city. I think there's something to take out of those ideas into a game, although I don't know that they're consistent with all of El's epithets. So, for example, he's also referred to as a bull god. But to me, you know, that seems a little bit pat. I'm not too concerned about making this kind of precise identification of El. I think to me the really interesting thing about him is that I don't know whether what I'm looking at reflects a lack of detail or clarity in the sources, or whether it just represents a god who was worshipped differently in different places or at different times. A deity who could be a supreme deity, a city deity, a cosmic deity, you name it. Here's the thing. This is true about a lot of the deities that we've covered on this show, and honestly, I think it may be that El specifically inspires this reflection in me because he's, you know, God. We're accustomed to the idea that, like, oh, that's Thor. He's the thunder god, and everybody who worships Thor does it in pretty much the same way. But as people who live in the modern world, we could hardly have failed to notice that is not true of God. There's a wide range of different responses to the idea of a deity or of God in a game setting. So if you're traveling in the real world and you heard people saying things like, God created the universe, God created humans. Okay, yeah, those definitely sound like things that people believe God did. But then also things like, God especially loves this city, or God guides the king and helps him make good decisions. Well, once again, those are absolutely all things that people have believed about God throughout the ages. And the idea that there is one big god, but then also a bunch of other gods, often their children, we've seen that idea several times, including with El analogs, including one interpretation of those early biblical texts. One interesting story that crops up in the Sen Kuniathon is the idea that El sacrificed his own son. We've mentioned the idea of child sacrifice in connection to Phoenician religion before, a practice that may have come to be associated with our concept of Moloch. And the extract goes into a little more detail about the background of this practice. So here I am quoting Eusebius's summary of Philo's translation of the possibly fictitious Sen Kuniathon. It was a custom of the ancients in great crises of danger for the rulers of a city or nation, in order to avert the common ruin, to give up the most beloved of their children for sacrifice as a ransom to the avenging demons, and those who were thus given up were sacrificed with mystic rites. Cronus, then, whom the Phoenicians call Elis, who was king of the country and subsequently, after his decease, was deified as the star Saturn, had, by a nymph of the country named Anabret, an only begotten son, whom they on this account called Eadud, the only begotten being still so called among the Phoenicians. And when very great dangers from war had beset the country, he arrayed his son in royal apparel, and prepared an altar, and sacrificed him. Now, that name for the son, Eadud, probably suggests that the son being referred to here is Baal-Hadad. There's actually another part of this same text that says that Cronus sacrificed his son to avert a pestilence, not a war. But this idea of a ruler being required to sacrifice a favorite child is a motif that we've seen in other places, obviously has a prominent place in the Bible, but also we've seen it in Greek mythology. I mentioned Baal-Hadad is one of many names for the Phoenician, Canaanite, Ugaritic, whatever, storm god. I would say that he's more commonly maybe called Baal-Zaphon. In Phoenician context, that's probably what I'm going to call him. And I think that this may connect to the identification of Cronus. It says that he's worshipped as Saturn, which is, of course, you know, associated with Cronus. But Baal-Zaphon is commonly associated with Zeus because he's also a storm god. So I suppose it makes sense that a Greek author would identify his father with Cronus. Normally, I think, and of course these things are not at all consistent, but normally I think that Baal's father is said to be Dagon, or Dagon, the grain god. known to you and me as Dagon, but we'll get to how that came to be at a later time. Now, obviously the Phoenicians are not the only culture to practice something like this, but one interpretation that I've always liked is in Larry Gonick's cartoon History of the Universe, I first encountered the idea that because Carthage didn't have like a king, right, it was governed by this council, essentially representing a group of aristocratic families, a bit like the Roman Senate. Because there was no one leader, no council member could be sort of seen to fall behind lest they potentially lose their position, nor to like get too far ahead of the others lest the others turn on them. And so the idea of sacrificing a child, making the ultimate sacrifice, was a way for members of the aristocracy to demonstrate shared commitment and a shared willingness to endure hardship. The idea of a god making a sacrifice is one that we've run into a few times already. Sometimes one asks the question, to whom? Here I think it's meant to be to this other creator deity, Elyon. It wouldn't surprise me to find that this is maybe a garbled version of a myth in which Baal sacrifices to El. I mean, who knows? Having said that, the idea of El as this powerful deity who has to be respected is not 100% widespread in the texts. So some theocritic texts actually have a pretty negative view of El. And that's something that we've seen in a few other cases. We definitely saw with Odin, that Odin, I mean, Thor gets like these kind of later stories that poke fun at him, where he's kind of a buffoon. And I don't know if those are, you know, written by later Christian writers who not only, you know, didn't worship Thor in the first place, but maybe were drawing on the literary tradition of kind of making fun of Heracles as a bit of a buffoon. And Thor obviously is a bit similar to Heracles. But also, someone, I think Saxo, calls Odin foul and untrue. El is often portrayed as kind of, well, I don't know about often, but he's certainly in some cases portrayed as kind of a doofus. Like, not a bad god, but maybe not like the most effective god. Is it wrong to call El the Commissioner Gordon of the cosmos, in that a bit like, you know, Enlil or Anu need to get things taken care of for them by Marduk or Ninurta, that the supreme deity, the creator, is not necessarily the go get stuff done guy. And there is a fella for that who is sort of younger and stronger, a prince kind of character. I do like something that comes up a lot in myths from the ancient Near East, is this idea of a god dwelling in a particular place. The deep where these springs are that the water comes from, you know, that El lives by. You know, I think the implication is that those are, I mean, they may have certain kind of mystical otherworldly qualities, but it sure seems like you could get to them on foot. And that's also a bit similar to the Epic of Gilgamesh. I like the idea of having the places where the gods live be real places in your landscape. Obviously, obligatory Glorantha reference, that is something that happens in Glorantha, although because the gods live in the gods' world, it's not exactly the same. But they have been in touch with the mortal world. But we're going to see this, you know, just like we've seen in other cultures, Phoenician deities are associated with particular features of the landscape, including sacred mountains. And in fact, I mentioned Baal Zafon. He's particularly associated with a certain mountain. And sometimes the mountain is said to be where he lives, and sometimes it is said to be him. So I don't know where the deeps where El lives are, but that would be like a cool place to visit. I imagine there's some pretty dangerous stuff down there. Like Inanna's descent into the underworld from the Sumerian chapter. Now in our games, I don't know that a player character, cleric of El, is necessarily going to come up very much. I would say that the cleric of El is some authoritative figure in flowing robes who stands to one side of the king and advises them. The cleric of El will tell you that, you know, powerful evil forces have turned their gaze on your quest and that kind of thing. But I don't know that it's a player character deity unless it's, you know, one of your wise clerics who knows a lot of things. Not that El is a particularly wise deity. It just seems like El is more a deity of the status quo, maybe. I don't know. But so that's Al, creator of the cosmos, creator of humanity, but maybe kind of sometimes a bit of a remote, aloof figure. Not always. Sometimes called El the Warrior. So some people clearly conceived of him as being more active. But in general, I would say that El fills our role for, you know, the king of the gods being a little bit distant. And the deity who interacts with mortals the most, not necessarily being the one that created them. I think that's something that we've seen in a number of other mythologies so far. All right, that is about all the Phoenician deities that we've got time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at some of the most important deities who appear in the pantheons of multiple cities as we take a look at Baal and, if time permits, Astarte. So I hope that you will join me then, right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.